Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, I'm N. Quentin Wolfe. This is Londonist Out Loud. How we interpret a thing is almost always influenced by context. Sometimes events here in London can change the context in which we come to you. We were planning to do a show about the army long before the atrocity that was carried out against a British soldier in the city this week. Some of the fallout has been to question whether the media has aided the alleged terrorists by giving them a platform, whether we've been a part of stoking up anger, particularly on the far right. I've thought a lot about whether it's okay to do this show, whether it could seem opportunistic or flippant. Worse, does it become some sort of statement in this new context? I believe that the chief way to respond to people who want chaos is with unswerving normality, which is not to say we don't feel, of course we do, and yet we don't let the provocations change what we're about. So this is the show as it was intended to go out, with nothing changed except this introduction. If it seems a little light of heart at times, or if I seem not to pick up on certain cues, you'll know why. I hope that the episode will contribute maybe just a little to the historical context of being a soldier in the British Army. Today's show is dedicated to drummer Lee Rigby and to those he leaves behind. London Michaelmas term lately over.
London?
Okay, you know where you are. A radical transformation.
Very radical transformation.
People are morally outraged with what's going on.
I got very excited this week.
Seems reasonable, doesn't it?
As soon as you scratch the surface, you realise gore happened all across London. Every open square would have a gallows.
A place called the Kittle Hoosie. Saw your Geordie's Grace riding on a goosey.
What the hell is that?
The man is tired of London. He's tired of London.
So what was the first thing that caught your eye?
The South has an overstuffed walrus.
It's very important history.
A handwritten letter from Charles Dickens.
There's a piece of information we're missing here somewhere.
You sneak through the city, what, immersing yourself in the sights, sounds,
and for the Jewish community, who came over in their tens of thousands from Russia, from Poland.
We are doing a modern take on Morris dancing.
When did he think the Second Coming was going to happen?
Yes, Boris, he wants to put an airport.
the tone with which Boris has announced that is fatigued.
Yes, the city is always changing. People frequently say to me, you know, won't it be wonderful when it's finished? And I say, no, it'll be dreadful. It'll mean it's dead.
Inform and entertain, that's what it's about.
London is a modern Babylon.
That's very true.
Can we have some of the detail here? Well, hello, hello. I am here in Chelsea, out of the window. Through the drizzle, I can see the Chelsea Hospital there, which obviously has very strong military connections. I'm in a building which arguably has even stronger military connections. I'm at the National Army Museum. Here with me is David Bounds, and he's the Assistant Director of Collections. Hi, David.
Hello. This is just such an amazing military environment. We've got the Royal Hospital next door, home of the famous Chelsea pensioners, and then just up the road on the King's Road, you've got the Duke of York's barracks, which is now the Saatchi Gallery. But really, this is military Chelsea. I mean, this has claims to be a World Heritage Site. This is an ancient seat of the British Army.
What's the purview of the museum? Clearly there's a suggestion in the title, but what are the nuances of what the collection's all about?
The National Army Museum is the museum of the British soldier. It's the museum of the soldier from, well, really from the 1660s to the present day. There are items in the collection that are earlier than that, so they go back to the medieval times, when armies were raised for specific campaigns. But basically, we go back to the time of the New Model Army, time of the English Civil War, when a professional standing army was raised. And we tell that story in our galleries in a chronological way from then right up to the present day and the experience of the British Army in Afghanistan.
We were having a bit of a debate off air as to whether I was contending, controversially perhaps, that the New Model Army was not called the New Model Army when it first appeared, and I'm going to get myself in trouble picking fights about army stuff with people who know everything about the army, but perhaps listeners may wish to contribute something on that one via the usual methods. You can drop us a tweet or an email if you've got a view on that. One view that might be prevalent, and I'm not sure whether it's valid or not, is that a lot of stuff around war and battles in the army, particularly exhibits thereof, you know, guns and weaponry and so forth, amounts to boys' toys, and really there's nothing in it for the female visitor, unless perhaps she happens to be unusually a soldier or something like that. Can we dispel that misconception?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is a museum about Britain's history, about all aspects of Britain's history. The army has shaped what modern Britain is about, and we tell the story about army wives, families, how the army has impacted on society, but also how the army has impacted on globally, because the British Army was a global army, an army that recruited from all corners of the world, and we have outstanding collections relating to the Indian Army, for example, which the museum was largely founded on that collection in 1947. So there's an awful lot to discover here that you might not necessarily associate with the history of the army. We've also got a fantastic diversity of collections, a great art collection, for example, fantastic costume collections. So there are different ways into the history of the army than just guns and tanks.
Yes, there's a fantastic exhibition amongst those existing or coming up about rehabilitative art, I know, as well. Maybe we should say something before we head off about the temporary exhibition at the moment to do with 20 battles.
I've got an exhibition at the moment which set out to decide what is Britain's most significant battle. What is its, if you like, greatest battle, although greatest is quite a problematic word. And in consultation, we selected 20 battles which we believe have played an important part in defining Britishness and Britain's place in the world. Some of those battles are moments that changed history. Others are defeats, some are localised importance, but all of which have a place in the debate about what makes a battle significant and what makes its sort of cultural legacy significant. Now, the voting on that has now finished. There was two types of voting, both online and in the gallery, but that's led to a debate about Britain's most significant battles, and you can see that exhibition on at the moment.
Finally, before we head down to the galleries, I think it might be interesting to separate the Imperial War Museum from the National Army Museum.
We're two very different organisations, although there are similarities. The Imperial War Museum deals with the period 1914, the beginning of the First World War, to the present day, and has quite a global remit, really, in looking at all aspects of conflict history in that period. National Army Museum is a much longer and broader remit altogether, going, like I said, right back to the English Civil War, 400 years plus of history of soldiering, the experience of being the British soldier. We're not a museum about the Air Force or the Navy. And it's also about the soldier's life and the impact of soldiering on British and world society.
Where are we headed first?
Well, I'm going to take you a look at some of the highlights from the collection, and I think it might be worth starting with the Napoleonic Wars and some real gems from the Battle of Waterloo.
Londonist Out Loud is available free as a stream at londonist.com or a weekly download via iTunes. Hit us up on Facebook at Londonist Out Loud. Tweet at Londonist Sound and check out images of our guests via the Londonist Out Loud stream on Instagram.
We are heading down now into the bowels of the museum. We've just gone past the transporter room. And, well, I tell you what's noticeable about the museum in the public areas as well as the private is its newness.
Yeah, the museum itself opened in the early 70s. And it's quite a sort of a brutalist modern building. And it's been refurbished in stages since then, with the most recent in the 2000s. You notice there's a lot of soldiers, serving soldiers, on visits to the museum. So a lot of these chaps who are wearing suits going around on their army cadets or or, you know, serving soldiers here to learn a bit about military history. Well, this is one of the main galleries called Changing the World, and this starts with the wars with revolutionary France in the 1780s and comes up to the Boer War at the turn of the 20th century. And when this gallery was put together about 20 years ago, at the time, it was a sort of a state-of-the-art museum gallery. And even now, you can see the sort of quality of the very lifelike display figures that we have here, and also the methods of interpretation. There's lots of films, like the ones you can hear in the background, putting the sort of wars and these campaigns into context.
What is the... if it has a central function, and of course it's to look at the history of the army... but is there a particular message that you're trying to get across about the army? About armies, I should say.
Well, what we say is that you can't really understand British history without understanding the history of the army. History of the army has sort of shaped all aspects of Britain's relationships with both with itself, but also with other countries. And we are the museum about the soldier and about the experience of the British soldier and how that's changed over time.
Well, we're next, as you say, to an imposing-looking fellow, a Swiss man practicing a military drill. I should mention he's a model rather than somebody who's employed to stand in this pose.
That's very true. And I think this chap was selected because the Napoleonic Wars, that period of warfare in the early 19th century, was global in its nature. I mean, we refer to it here as being the First World War, because it was spread across the world, not just in Europe, and both Western and Eastern Europe, but also in the West Indies and elsewhere. And it also gives us an opportunity to show off some of our costume collection, and you can see lots of examples on display here of absolutely spectacular sort of tunics and headdress from the end of the 18th century and the beginning of the 19th century. And the National Army Museum has got one of the world's biggest collections of male occupational dress, which is a bit of a mouthful of really just saying that we've got one of the biggest costume collections of any museum. And it is an incredible strength. And a strength, I think, that's not always appreciated, because the story about British military uniforms is the story of British textiles and is a story of fashion. So we work a lot with fashion students and sometimes with fashion houses as well, because the style of military tailoring, quality of the cloth, and the history behind how these were made, the sort of the industry that grew up around supplying the British Army, is what enabled us to have the sort of clothing industry that we have.
Right, and this was a time, of course, when it was a big deal to have brightly coloured fabrics. They were much more expensive to produce. There's lovely golden buttons on some of the uniforms we can see here. I know that, is it various regiments or have different button patterns and so forth? But the key thing, of course, is that all the uniforms in the display cabinets around us right now feature red, if not as the vastly dominant colour. Certainly, it's very present. Lots of embellishments, lots of flourishes, lots of other bright colours. At what point did the British Army decide that it would be better to blend in?
To start off with, I mean, the Army, we were using red coats from that sort of New Model Army time, you know, the Civil War period, and that became what the British Army was famous for, became a way of identifying the Army. But there's lots of myths about the red coat. It's often said, for example, that it was selected because you wouldn't see the blood on the battlefield or the blood of a wound, or even that it enabled the commanders to recognise their troops. But actually, in the sort of fog of war and the sort of mist and haze, troops were often indistinguishable anyway because of the dust and various cavalry uniform units the British Army didn't wear red either. It was just the colour that had been adopted for most infantry regiments. There wasn't a sort of a moment in the 19th century where the British High Command woke up and thought, hang on, you know, our soldiers being dressed in red, this is a bit of a giveaway to the enemy about where they are, we need to camouflage them better. It was a more sort of gradual process than that, that began at the end of the 19th century, when in some colonial campaigns and imperial actions, uniform issue began to reflect more the sort of fighting conditions the soldiers found themselves in. But this became standard issue dress in the Boer War. The Boer War started in 1899 in South Africa, and soldiers were issued with this khaki-coloured uniform, khaki being an Indian word for dust. And those early uniforms that you see from that period have a very sandy colour, different from the sort of olive drab colour that you might associate with the army at home today. Although, I suppose for many people, what we're familiar with now is the army serving in Afghanistan, where the uniforms are once again a sandy camouflage colour rather than being that sort of green from earlier times.
You said there wasn't a sort of a particular moment where it changed, but at the same time it sounds as though something happened in someone's mind in relation to the Boer conflict where they decided perhaps it was better not to be easily spottable.
Well, I think that's right. The Boer War was the first time that the army, the whole of the army was equipped in some sort of camouflage material, in this case being that sort of khaki. And as that war evolved in particular, where the Boers, the farmers who lived there that we were fighting against, became particularly adept at using natural camouflage and in their tactics of attacking the British army, it became more and more apparent that soldiers needed to blend in with their environment.
I see. Okay, so really this is all about fighting tactics. I'm presuming up until that point it had been ranks and standing in a line and trying not to get shot, whereas now it's more about ducking and diving.
There's certainly more flexibility, and you get first uses of trenches and sort of, you know, shock troops as well at this time. So, yes, those big standard battles that the Napoleonic period is so famous for, they have of course gone by the end of the 19th century, but it took a long time. You know, in the Zulu Wars, British Army are still fighting in quite traditional formations.
I know we're going to find ourselves talking about some of the other rapid evolutions in martial tactics, equipment and so forth in just a moment, but we are heading at the moment towards even more ornate costumes, if that's possible. I can now see a gold headdress with leopard skin on it. It's not getting any subtler. What are we looking at here?
Well, we're now looking at a display case connected with the Battle of Waterloo in 1815. Battle, of course, which has an anniversary in a couple of years' time, and there's a lot of preparation going on around the country right now to commemorate that battle. What we've got in front of us here, though, is a series of artefacts that are taken from the battlefield itself in June 1815. Perhaps most striking of all, there's a French eagle that was captured by the Royal Dragoons at the Battle of Waterloo from the 105th Infantry Regiment, the French. But there's lots of other things here. There's a French Dragoon's helmet, which is the brass and animal skin pattern that you were referring to before, as well as a sort of bearskin of one of the French grenadier companies who fought to the last man at the battle itself. One of our most popular items here, though, is a saw, as a medical saw, and a glove. And this was this glove was worn by a medical officer who was given the job of sawing the leg off the Earl of Uxbridge at the Battle of Waterloo. Now, the Earl of Uxbridge was Wellington's second in command. And famously, they were observing the battle from their horses, and an explosion went off nearby, and Uxbridge said to Wellington, "Oh, my God, sir, I've lost my leg." And Wellington is supposed to have replied, "My God, sir, so you have." And Uxbridge was taken off to a field, a medical centre, where his leg was sawn off by this very saw, and the surgeon who did it wore that very glove, which is still sort of soaked with a blood stain that you can see there. We've got a lot of this sort of medical equipment in the collection, and it always attracts a lot of interest because, you know, back in the days for anaesthetic, you know, if a limb was hanging off, it had to be removed very quickly. So a surgeon only had a few moments in which to perform this sort of surgery and to then stop the bleeding afterwards, or the patient would literally bleed to death.
And this is pre-anaesthetic.
It's pre-anaesthetic. It's pretty much everything. Pretty horrible being wounded on the battlefield 200 years ago, and you didn't have a very high survival rate if you were seriously injured, and you just hoped that you weren't the first person to have your leg sawn off that day, because these saws got very blunt as the day went on.
What became of the Earl of Uxbridge?
Well, the Earl of Uxbridge had a long life afterwards. He lived up in North Wales. He became Lord Anglesey, and he had a prosthetic leg, or several prosthetic limbs, some of which are preserved at Plasnewith, which is the family house up there. We've actually recently acquired some spurs that were worn by him after the Battle of Waterloo, and they are modified to take to to fit into his wooden leg, because he remained a very keen horse rider after the battle, despite losing his leg.
For those not up with their military history, what was the significance of the Battle of Waterloo in a nutshell?
Well, the Battle of Waterloo ended Napoleon's reign in Europe. Napoleon had come to power in the early 1800s, although France had already been at war with many of Europe's major powers for a number of years. He was defeated in 1814 and sent to prison, where he escapes, returned to France, and started a new 100 Days campaign, as it was subsequently called. And Waterloo was this huge battle fought by the British and the Prussians and by the French, but also by many international brigades. There were German troops there on the side of the British, Irish troops there, and there were troops from many other nations as well.
Dutch troops, I think.
There was a big Dutch contingency, and Swiss and others too. And this battle really did mark the sort of end of Napoleon's reign, and I think in Britain it's celebrated as a great British victory, although in Germany it's often celebrated as a great German victory, because Germans or the Prussians were commanded by General Blücher, and he's probably as famous, if not more famous, in parts of Germany than Wellington is here. And we've got an amazing contemporary model of the Battle of Waterloo, which I'd like to show you now. What I'm looking at now is a huge-scale model of the Battle of Waterloo that was put together by a man called Siburn in the 1820s and early 1830s. And this really is quite a remarkable piece of work, because what Siburn did was he wrote to as many people who'd served and fought on the battle as he could find. And the result is a particular moment in the late afternoon, where the troops are shown in the actual depositions that they were at that time. So it's not to sort of a general view of the battle, it's an actual moment. And it shows the British and the French troops. It's a bit of a political model, though. Wellington was involved with it, and other members of the British establishment too. And there's one sort of thing which is noticeably absent on it, and that is the entire Prussian army, who don't figure at all and should be occupying quite a big space in the middle distance there, coming to save the day, as they did towards the end of the day.
So this is the Saving Private Ryan of Battle of Waterloo.
It is. It shows really that it's a piece of social history as much as it is a piece of military history, because Wellington, it was seen as a great British victory. I mean, yeah, rightly so. I mean, it was largely a British victory, but this is taking whitewashing to an extreme and removing the Prussians altogether.
We turn to the left from that beautiful illuminated model. By the way, I like what you've done with the lights moving around the field to show us what's going on there, and we see the skeleton of a horse.
Well, this is Napoleon's horse, Marengo, which he allegedly rode at the Battle of Waterloo, or rather, he did ride Marengo at the Battle of Waterloo, and we believe that this is Marengo's skeleton. It came from the imperial stables and with excellent provenance. You notice, though, it's got two hooves down at the bottom of the case. There are a number of these hooves in existence, and I think so far I've counted five, but others keep on popping up out of the woodwork. So it was a multi-legged horse, if its surviving number of hooves is to be believed.
This is like pieces of the cross in days gone by.
It is like pieces of the cross, but we have two, as you can see here, and there are others in museum collections.
Well, that's the whistle-stop tour of the Battle of Waterloo, but let's move further back in time. We've come down half a level, and there's a man pointing a gun at me. These guys are wearing woolly hats, carrying pike staffs. This is looking a lot like the Civil War.
Yes, the scene that we're looking at is from the Battle of Naseby in 1645, and we've got a pikeman and a musketeer from the New Model Army. This was this new professional army put together by Oliver Cromwell on behalf of Parliament to fight the royalist forces of Charles I. And the guys are in these sort of russet red jackets. They were all costumed in the same way. The musketeer has got a matchlock musket, which where the powder was lit in an open pan with a long, like a piece of cord, or it looks like a piece of rope, but called a match in the language of the time. And that was a smouldering light source which was used to light the powder in the pan of the musket.
So you're saying that this piece of cord hanging from the thing was constantly smouldering?
Constantly lit, with a small sort of light, like a cigarette almost, if you like. And you would you'd put that into the pan of the musket along with the powder, put the ball down the barrel, and then you'd blow on the match to get a spark to ignite the powder and shoot the musket out.
Does that mean they couldn't fight if it was raining?
Pretty much they couldn't fight if it was raining, because the wooden stock would also swell up. But sometimes it didn't work anyway, because these are fairly inaccurate weapons. And then kneeling in front of the musketeer is a pipeman. And this is a very typical pipeman of the age, with about an 18-foot pike. The pike detachment of a battalion at that time were used to protect the musketeers, and they would they'd form a sort of a hedgehog defensive position that the musketeers could fire from behind, fire at cavalry. And we have here a depiction of a English Civil War cavalryman, slightly earlier, from about 1643, and he's wearing the sort of uniform and armour that the cavalry wore at that time. He's got a metal breastplate and backplate on, and he's got a special metal helmet, very distinctive for this period, sometimes called a lobster tail helmet, which has an articulated piece at the back to protect the back of the neck from sword blows, and then a movable visor at the front, again to deflect sword blows, because his job would be to come in amongst the pikemen, finish off the musketeers.
Right, so this is a very particular time, isn't it? We've gone past that point where the knights on the horses were wearing full armour, and if they were off the horse, they were in serious shtuck. But we are already at the point where you can do long-distance fighting with at least some accuracy by firing weapons, rather than having to get in close.
The muskets were really most effective en masse. I mean, these aren't like modern-day rifles, where a rifle is called that because it has rifling in the barrel, which allows the bullet to spin and gives more accuracy over a longer distance. These were quite inaccurate weapons, just firing a ball of lead from an explosive powder shot. And so it was best to mass them all together and fire at the ranks of the enemy in the hope that you'd hit them, rather than aiming carefully at someone coming towards you.
Did the lead bullets stay together, or did they split open into shot? How did they work?
They stay together, and there's lots of accounts of how a lead ball might pass through several people. I mean, these are, if it did hit you, they were awful wounds could be caused by them. But you see, though, with these new model army soldiers, neither of them are wearing armour. This is the pikeman and the musketeer. But earlier on in the war, pikemen in particular did wear armour. They wore this sort of breastplate and backplate, and they wore thigh protectors. I can show you some of those in this display case here. And these thigh protectors were articulated, or sometimes they look articulated but aren't.
We're looking, by the way, listener, at a metal miniskirt, essentially.
It's a metal miniskirt attached by hooks to the bottom of the breastplate worn on the chest. And these are called tassets, and they were designed to protect the thighs. Pretty useless and very cumbersome. Soldiers quickly discarded them, in fact, just to retain the breast and backplate. Because when you're fighting essentially against swords and pikes, that's what you need to protect yourself from. Also on display here are some of the early forms of armour. There's a leather buff coat. This was a leather jerkin worn under the armour. It's sort of shaped in at the waist and flares out, again, to protect the upper thighs. As the war developed, the English Civil War, many soldiers and officers just wore this because it gives you greater flexibility and can deflect a sword blow.
Now, we've been looking, of course, at the costumes in particular, because they're, in some ways, they're an easy way into the time. There's something that's tangible and still exists here, preserved beautifully in the museum. What about the army as a sort of an administrative machine, as a structure? How has it changed since the time when people were wearing these costumes?
Well, the army, of course, has become a far more professional organisation in terms of training of ordinary soldiers and of the officer corps, with a huge administration behind it about the supply of troops. I mean, this period here, the English Civil War, 1640s, yet in a period of amateur soldiering. And that amateur tradition survived for quite some time. So even 19th century, when you start to get a more organised and disciplined British army, you still get officers talking about it being a bad day for the army when it's run by professional soldiers. So the 19th century is the big period of explosion for reform of the army. But it's the 20th century where you get sort of modern forms of training that we know today.
I'm wondering whether the Civil War was the point at which the assembling of forces moved from it being all the people who owe allegiance to a particular feudal lord or something like that, to it being people fighting for a cause, as it was in the Civil War.
The creation of the new model army is really that time where you get people becoming professional soldiers, and then after that you have people enlisting or being press ganged into joining the army. So they're then soldiers for life rather than just being called up. Because before the Civil War, Britain didn't have standing armies. Armies were raised to counter a particular emergency, and grants of money were raised by Parliament at that time as well, in the days before income tax, usually to fight a foreign war. And there's lots of ways in which soldiers might be recruited at that time or drafted. They could have been people who worked on the estate of a great lord, or areas could have had some sort of feudal system where each village had to supply a couple of men horsed and harnessed in the language of the time, ready to repel invaders from Scotland or to join the king's army on a continental adventure. So there's lots of ways in which those troops would be raised, but the expectation was that they would be disbanded. After the Civil War, you get professional soldiers who spend their entire life as a soldier and progress through the ranks.
We are passing now through exhibits from the Boer War. A British infantryman here depicted sitting writing letters home, through to a gallery with exhibits from the days of national service. Now that's something I didn't register earlier on, is that that was at the same time as the Cold War was in its chilly heights.
Indeed, and there are many sort of forgotten wars and periods of conflict from the 1950s, Malaya, the Mau Mau rising in East Africa and elsewhere, and I think a lot of these have been forgotten. National service wasn't just about being in the barracks in the UK. There were lots of actions that were taking place.
Londonist Out Loud is sponsored by Audible. To claim your free audiobook from a range of 60,000 titles, try the Audible service on a 30-day free trial. Audiobooks can be saved as MP3s and played on your compatible phone, tablet or desktop, or burned to CD, and they're yours to keep. For your free audiobook, go to www.audible.co.uk/Londonist and click through.
We've got a temporary exhibition on at the moment about what was Britain's greatest battle. I think that's a very interesting question to ask. What is it about the nature of battle that makes it particularly significant? Is it the impact that it's had on modern-day Britain? Is it because it was a great victory or similarly a great defeat? Or is it something which is just remembered in popular culture? What is the essence of this? So the museum, working with the academics on the staff, came up with a shortlist, a very controversial shortlist, of 20 battles that Britain had been involved with since the end of the 18th century, and then put that to a public vote, both online and a physical vote that you could vote for in the galleries. Now, that voting has now closed, but it's very interesting, I think, to have a look at some of the nominations for what it was that made Britain's greatest battle.
Yes, and maybe the listener might be thinking about having a guess themselves as to which would fall into the category of the, in inverted commas, greatest battle. I think we could suspend the revelation of the online vote for a moment or two, as that is guessable. What I would say is that the number one, according to the academics here, is from the Second World War, and yet it's one, even with a reasonable amount of knowledge of that war, that I've certainly never heard of. Am I shamefully ignorant?
Well, no. I think the campaigns the British Army fought against the Japanese in the Far East are not well known, particularly when you compare these with D-Day, Normandy landings, the Battle for France, or even the great battles between Russia and Germany in Stalingrad and elsewhere, which have become much better known recently. I think the battles in the jungle against the Japanese have fallen from popular consciousness, and the winner of the top 20 British battles, according to a sort of a panel of a voting event that took place, is the Battle of Imphal and Kohima in the Second World War in 1944. Now, this was a period of sort of dreadful sort of hand-to-hand fighting between the British and the Japanese forces. And it's one of the most sort of... It was a real turning point in that war with Japan, a grueling battle where Japan was defeated and pushed back, allowing for the reconquest of Burma.
And aside from the clear drama and bravery that must have been put to the test under these grueling circumstances, what put that battle ahead of some of the other more globally renowned confrontations?
I think we had an event here, a day event, where the top five battles were discussed and debated. I think a very powerful case for this one was put across. Some battles remain in the popular consciousness; they are famous. But this was decisive at that moment in the Burma campaign, and deserves a higher acknowledgement.
Something that's slightly concerning me is, and of course, this is all about representing the history of an organisation, and we might perhaps touch on the relationship with the Ministry of Defence shortly. But to my mind, of course, war is a horrible, terrible thing, with pieces being shot off people and misery and death ensuing. I wonder whether the idea of a greatest battle, perhaps some of the kind of noble and valorous exhibits here, fails to quite address that.
Well, this is essentially an exhibition about, you know, what is it, the nature of battle that makes us believe that something is great or not great. And some of the battles here are defeats, sometimes quite spectacular defeats, or most recently a battle, an action that's really not very well known, in Operation Herrick in Afghanistan, the Battle of Musa Kala in 2006-2007. And that isn't a traditional warfare that we would recognise. It's an ongoing fight between British forces and insurgents, with moments which might appear like the sort of war film battles that we're familiar with at the cinema. But I'm much more about endurance and the professionalism of the British Army. There is an element with some early campaigns of a sort of a gung-ho approach to the way they've been popularly remembered. But what we try and do here is to bring different interpretations to bear on that. In an exhibition like this, it's a very sort of condensed version of each campaign. But in our permanent galleries, we talk much more about the social cost of that, the advances in medicine that those warfares might have developed, but also, you know, what it was like to be there. And as you rightly say, most of the first-hand accounts are about the horrors of warfare. I mean, that is the consistent theme. One of the battles that we put forward for the top 20 was the Battle of the Somme. I don't think anyone would think of the Battle of the Somme as being like a great battle, a top 20 event. That's not the appropriate sort of language to describe that. But what we're trying to get at here is that these are battles which in the popular consciousness, which in the history of Britain, have helped to shape that history, helped to define Britishness. And the Somme is probably one of the most famous of all battles fought by Britain. Somme was, of course, in July 1916. And actually, if we have a look at the artefact that's been selected for this, because for each of the battles, there's only one artefact that's been selected, whether it's a bayonet or a uniform or a painting. And for the Somme, we have here the tunic of an officer who lost his arm at the Battle of the Somme. And it's, the tunic is a rather sort of grisly relic of that war. His right sleeve is torn just beneath the shoulder and then completely missing where it was blown off. And the rest has been stitched back together in quite a sort of Frankenstein way, because, of course, he would have reused this uniform afterwards. You can see at the bottom, though, there is still the mud of the Somme attached to it. So this is a very poignant item, a very poignant reminder of the reality of conflicts. And if you compare this with some of the 19th century paintings, and we have over here, for example, a scene from the Charge of the Light Brigade showing the heavy brigade attacking Russian positions during the Crimean War in the 1850s. And here is a painting which we're much more familiar with, the sort of horses dashing across open ground, soldiers with cavalrymen with their swords aloft. And this seems, although representing a terrible slaughter and representing a disaster for Britain militarily, it's designed to elicit a feeling of patriotism and excitement about warfare, which is simply not the way we look at warfare in the 21st century, or indeed most of the 20th century as well.
So in a gallery that is all about battles, it seems as almost as though the concept of battles is close to being outdated in terms of how warfare is conducted.
That's certainly the case now. We are looking to redevelop the museum at the moment, and we're looking for an interpretive approach to it, so like a thematic approach about how we might deal with this complex history. And you look at the way military history has been presented up to now in museums, it's chronological and it deals with one battle after another. And right now, that may well not be the way future conflicts are fought. Although, you know, history has a habit of playing tricks on us, and you know, who knows, we might return to and I hope not, but we might return to a period where there is some very large traditional staged warfare. It very much depends on who the combatants are, because of course when one side is militarily inferior to another, it's not going to engage that side on in open warfare in the grand manner of the 19th century, or even in the sort of carnage of the First World War. It's going to be done through improvised explosive devices. It's going to be done through insurgency and terrorism.
Right, and in the case of, I don't know, a Libya or something like that, lots of different factions all mixed in together, both politically and geographically, difficult to tell who's who, not as clear-cut as the people in the red coats on one side, blue coats on the other. With the Ministry of Defence connection, about which perhaps we could say something now, I wondered how you deal with representing the wars that are ongoing.
Well, we are the Museum of the British Army, and we're funded by the Ministry of Defence, but we're not managed by the Ministry of Defence in that matter. We keep editorial control, and that's very important. It's very important for visitors. It's also very important, I think, for the MOD as well, because as an organisation, we need to be impartial. And I think for us, that means that we take a measured approach to the experience of the British Army in Afghanistan. We have respect for the British Army, and we want to show the work that the British Army is doing there, the professionalism of that work. But across time, that relationship with the MOD doesn't prevent us from being critical of the history of the British Army when we need to be critical. And of course, there are many times with any army, any nation, where armies have fallen short of the expectations that civilians might have of them for whatever reason that has happened. And I think for some of those events over time, and we are dealing with a 400-year period, we need to have the freedom, and we do have the freedom, to address those issues and talk about stuff which is quite difficult from a modern-day perspective. I think, for example, of issues of cowardice and bravery. The First World War is especially famous in the popular mind for the way in which people were treated through what we would now call post-traumatic stress disorder. And you need to, I think, as a modern museum, to treat that sort of issue sympathetically. And also to be critical where the British Army has perhaps been involved in actions which we wouldn't condone from a 21st century perspective.
Before we move on to our final exhibit here at the National Army Museum, I've become increasingly conscious of the elephant in the room, which is, of course, that, and apart from until very, very recently, this is a story about men, specifically a genderized story. And I sort of feel that if this were a reversed situation. For example, if we were talking about nursing, I think gender would be highly prominent. But I haven't seen so far any mention of gender, and I wondered about that.
Well, the museum reflects the experience of the British soldier, and for a long time, of course, that was a male profession. But even early on in the displays, we talk about the role of women in the army where that's appropriate. So famously in the Crimea War, for example, where you have Florence Nightingale, but also less well-known perhaps Mary Seacole and others who were working as nurses. And there's always been that sort of female contingent. But equally important, of course, is the experience of soldier as part of a family, as part of society. And that is something that we touch on in parts of the gallery. But the 20th century and beyond story of female regiments, that is something that we address, and we have very large collections from ex-regimental museums dealing with the experience of female soldiers in the 20th century.
And now, you see, I've said gender, and you've assumed I'm talking about female gender, but what I was interested in was the experience of not merely being a soldier, but being a male. So, for example, where you talk about the family side of things, it seems to me that little mention gets made of the people left behind and the missing the family responsibilities that can't be fulfilled because you're out on the front, or indeed just the whole issue of every so often the country deciding to send a lot of its men folk out into these horrific conditions.
That's a very interesting and valid point. I think at the moment, the National Army Museum tells the story of the army chronologically, and that is sort of driven by battles and campaigns and the artifacts associated with those campaigns. It is something, though, that we've realised, and we are absolutely addressing that in our new museum. So, subject to funding, when the museum closes, the whole narrative story of the army as represented here will change, and will go from a sort of chronological wars story to something much more thematic, where some of those themes will be about the experience of being a soldier and looking at that comparatively over time. Now, you can find that stuff here today in the museum, but it tends to be split between galleries. And in the new museum, we want to bring that together and look at that experience across time, but really address just those sort of questions. What does it mean to be a soldier? And combat and active service is only one aspect of that.
Well, finally, we come to the fantastically named Conflicts of Interest Gallery, and we're tying in with what we were talking about just a moment ago. This is a picture, really, that could only have existed in more recent years, the enormous 10-12-foot picture that faces us from the other end of the gallery, a female soldier, a Red Cross armband on, and a machine gun in her hands.
Well, this is a much more recent and modern gallery than the ones we were just looking at here. And this gallery looks at Britain's involvement in conflict over the last 40 years, the changing nature of conflict. And this does look at the impact of the soldier at home and on recruitment and the increasing use of female soldiers in combat zones. There's a great series of posters as we go in from recruitment from the last 20 or 30 years. Recruitment posters are a sort of fascinating mirror about the nature of British society. When I was growing up in the 1970s, the emphasis was all on join the British Army and you can go skiing and you can see the world. But, you know, the result of sort of cheap holidays, that's much less of a appeal than it used to be. 100 years ago, it was all about patriotism.
You there, join up.
Indeed. No, that was exactly it. Whereas now, it's about, if you look at some of the posters that you see here, it's about professionalism. It's about how, if you're in the British Army, you will be trained to such standards of professionalism that should you choose to leave the Army, you will be multi-skilled, transferable skills. Or if you choose to stay in the Army, you'll have a full and rewarding career, both sort of stimulating intellectually and worthwhile and financially rewarding. It's a very sort of different emphasis on the professionalism of the Army.
And utterly well-founded as well. I know, having come into contact with a number of ex-servicemen, that the availability of courses as they re-enter Civvy Street are really quite remarkable.
It's extraordinary. It's extraordinary how well-trained British soldiers are today. I mean, the British Army is a highly trained, highly professional organisation. And I think that's what we can see in this exhibition, in fact.
We're looking at a picture of six uniformed soldiers carrying a coffin draped in the Union flag.
Each of the recruitment posters that we have on display in the entrance here is backed on with an image showing another aspect of the British Army's experience. So there's a large photograph of soldiers returning from Afghanistan being issued with medals. There's parades in towns, because an important part of sort of municipal life, civic life in certain areas. But there's also, as you rightly say, a picture here of a coffin draped in the Union flag of a soldier who died in service being brought back by his comrades, possibly to Wooden Bassett, which has become such a symbol of the loss of life in Afghanistan.
We find I can never remember, was it Haig or Kitchener who's pointing the finger?
Kitchener. Kitchener's famous poster from the First World War, Your Country Needs You, which was drawn by Alfred Leitz, a major commercial artist at the time. And that has been hugely parodied since by the Americans. They used it for their own recruitment campaigns.
Oh, yes, the Uncle Sam pointing.
Uncle Sam, by a chap called Montgomery Flagg, who drew it. But there's been many sort of skits of it since. In the late 1990s and 2000s, the British Army reissued it themselves with different faces imposed on Kitchener's face to show the diversity of the British Army, but with the same message, your country needs you.
We've come to the final gallery of our visit, but by no means the final gallery of the museum as a whole. Now, okay, these display pieces, they're glass, and they've got information on them, and they're lit from below, and this is very much next generation territory, but this is really the next generation of warfare, or at least the very cutting edge of the current one. We've got drones here, we've got a helmet here. Now, back to the sci-fi theme, I think we recognise the helmet that's in the display case just here, relating to Basra and Saddam Hussein and that war.
Yes, it's a helmet from Hussein's personal bodyguard, and he was very influenced by the iconography of Star Wars, or at least it would seem so from this helmet, which is clearly modelled on a sort of Darth Vader-style helmet. Fortunately, though, they were out of cash, and they were made out of fibreglass. Those helmets are quite useless as a method of protection.
So just fancy dress?
Pretty much just fancy dress. But this gallery as a whole is the last 40 years. It's a very modern gallery. It talks about the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, about the troubles in Northern Ireland, and the changing and evolving role of the British Army. And it's got some great stuff. As you come in, you come into a modern-day living room, and that's all about how ideas about the army, ideas about soldiering, come into the home through television, novels, books, and music. And you know, how that influences what people think, whether they want to join up or whether they want to protest. But the gallery itself looks at those campaigns that Britain's been involved with.
And we come now to a comments board.
It's very important, I think, for people to have an opportunity to respond to what they've seen. And the comments we get here are often of a very reflective nature. People often be very moved by what they've seen, and they feel necessary to leave a comment behind for other visitors to read.
Let's pick a few at random and see what sort of things people are saying as they respond to the exhibits here at the National Army Museum.
Well, there's one here, for example. I'm just picking this at random, but it says, thinking of you when you're away, we love you so much, you fill us with pride, love you mum and dad. And obviously that's the parents of a serving soldier.
Hate war. We should all hate war, but without the armed forces we would be living in a different world. We must never forget these brave people, says JB. Another says, the soldiers are faithful and true to our country and have dedicated their lives to being a soldier. And I would say from the handwriting, that's a much younger person, and there are three love hearts drawn underneath that.
You can see there's a lot of comments here from children, often in the sort of like no war, peace, that sort of thing. But on the whole, I mean, we don't sort of mediate this, we let people put up their own comments. But you can see generally, there's like a mood of quiet remembrance. You know, I think that's the modern attitude, isn't it? We respect and support the army. We don't always agree with what Britain has to do abroad, and we acknowledge that the army is doing an often intolerable job on our behalf, and for that we support them.
Which is the point at which we must bring our tour of the National Army Museum to a close. David Bounds, where can people find out more and get directions to come here in Chelsea?
The best place is to go to our website, National Arms Museum, which lists all the events that we've got on and our opening times. We're open from 10 till 5:30, 7 days a week, and admission is free. You can see all of this great stuff. We're on the Royal Hospital Road in Chelsea. The nearest tube station is Sloane Square. Got a fantastic programme of events on. We have a free weekly lecture on a Thursday, and we have a guest lecture programme once a month. Next speaker we have is Andy McNabb on the 23rd of May, talking about his famous book, Bravo 2-0. Lots of stuff going on for kids, kids zone, kids events as well. So have a look at the website. Come on down.
David Bounce, thanks very much.
Thank you very much indeed.
And that's all for this week. My thanks for this week to David Bounds. Thanks too to Becca Evans and Bernie Barkley. Theme and incidental music was by Jack Hurd and Rory Anderson. I'm N. Quentin Wolfe. Inch by inch, waiting for the river's care, straining for the blueing waves calling from the shore.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.